From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Residents of Russia's capital city, Moscow, braved a steady wintry mix Tuesday to lay flowers and light candles at the Leningrad Monument of the Russian Hero City's memorial along the Kremlin Wall for victims of a bomb in the St. Petersburg metro Monday that left, at last count, at least 14 people dead and more than 40 injured. Russia's investigative committee said it had established the identity of the suicide bomber who apparently detonated the explosive device after examining the suspected attacker's remains from the blast site in the city's metro. A spokesperson for the investigative committee, Svetlana Petrenko, told Interfax that, while the bomber's identity was known, details would not yet be disclosed given the ongoing investigation, noting that authorities were, quote, carrying on with interrogations and inspecting CCTV cameras, closed quote. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., some are calling it a smoking gun. Bloomberg reported Monday that former National Security Advisor Susan Rice made multiple requests for the identities of people connected to the Trump transition team contained in raw intelligence reports. The author of that piece cited U.S. officials familiar with the matter. This was Bloomberg contributor Eli Lake in an interview about that piece of his, exposing the requests after being asked if Rice had actually received any of the redacted names she requested to be unmasked.
It was described to me that she would often put in the request after seeing an intelligence report and she would get it within that day. So, yes.
For more on this and the continuing Russiagate furor, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero, live via Skype from Philadelphia Tuesday.
I think this is significant. We're beginning, or at least the public is beginning, to get a sense of how dysfunctional the American political class is, which has great significance because, as we've discussed before, there is a crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of governance in the United States. It looks like the Senate is going to do away with the filibuster, which would make it, as they say, more like the House of Representatives, where whoever is in the majority, whichever party is in the majority, could push through whatever they want without any consideration of the minority party, which always had the weapon of the filibuster. Of course, the evidence now coming out that at least somebody high up in the Obama White House was responsible for unmasking and leaking names of people in the Trump transition and in the Trump campaign who were caught on what is considered normal surveillance of Russian and other nations' diplomats. Usually those names of Americans are redacted or, whited out. But in this case, they were leaked, and this has dire consequences. But I think overall, at the end of the day, we're looking at a profound crisis of governance in the United States. As you know, I have said, and I still believe, that the Trump administration and Trump himself will not be able to effectively govern if he will be able to govern at all. And there's just too much militating against a normal government. For example, the way things are set up in this country, to govern, you need the cooperation, if not the complete agreement, of the corporate media. Well, in the case of Trump, the corporate media is completely against him. and to govern, there has to be what they call some form of bipartisanship. That is completely out of the question with the Democrats, both in the Senate and the House, pursuing this Russiagate foolishness. You need to at least have formal unity within the majority party, the party that, let us say, holds the presidency and maybe one of two of the houses of Congress. In the case of the Republicans now, they have the presidency and both houses of Congress. But the fact of the matter is, as shown in the repeal and replace of Obamacare, that Trump does not have that. And the Freedom Caucus looks like it's gearing up for a fight with Ryan, who is in a tactical alliance, at least on repeal and replace with the Obama White House.
Trump White House. Yeah.
Pardon me, the Trump, forgive me, Trump White House, that the Freedom Caucus is targeting him to be brought down. And this is a very important development, because what it seems that we are looking at is the at least weakening, if not the end, of the two-party duopoly as we have known it. These parties, starting perhaps with the politicians and the elected officials at the national level, could begin to so fragment that we do not have the two parties as we have known them, and the various sides will not even be capable of tactical unity in the interest of policy. So that's the way I'm looking at things right now. And that is not taking into consideration the international global situation. Yeah. And President Xi Jinping of China coming to the United States at the end of this week.
And you've discussed for quite a while now that regardless of who was elected, for example, in November, that the multiple crises of legitimacy and the multiple material crises of the economy, the political system, and a number of other very important institutional frameworks are, all operating to make the country ungovernable, including a very mm-hmm. angry and divided electorate.
Absolutely. And I think that's key, because in spite of the institutional frameworks through which elites govern a nation, the pattern of mass disaffection and mass anger is across borders. It's in France, it's in Britain, it's in Germany, it's in Holland, it's in Italy, it's in South Africa, it's in South Korea. If you take the nations of what is called the G20, what were known as the major capitalist countries, the G7, which became the G8 with Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, and then the major emerging, what they call emerging markets like China and India, South Africa, and others. If you take the G20 countries, I dare say that two-thirds of them are in some form or another of crises of political rule, crises of governance. Now, from the standpoint of the narrative of the neoliberal elite, this is a rightward move. But I think if we look more closely, what the and I put quotes around this, what the right has taken advantage of is the anger of perhaps the majority of the people in the countries that we are talking about. This is not just an American affair. This is throughout the world, and it is having the effect of bringing governments down, of bringing new alliances into power, and in some instances, the coming together of the social democratic and even socialist left, in the case of France, perhaps even a communist left, with some of the positions that are held by the alleged far right, like in France, Le Pen and the representatives of the left in France.
You know, it's interesting also, among the G20, you have some cases where the governments were actually removed by the U.S. backing right-wing forces, Argentina, mm-hmm. Brazil, mm-hmm. for example, those two places. That same struggle taking place in Venezuela right now, which isn't a member, but a sizable yeah. economy. And the situation, of course, in South Korea, which is one of the G20, and Mexico, and, you know, there are many others. Turkey, very unstable. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, probably the mm-hmm. most unstable on the planet. All of this this instability is just manifest throughout.
Yes, yes. I mean, and that's the name of the game, I think, instability and ungovernability. I think that's what we're looking at. Now, this brings us, of course, back to Russiagate. And Russiagate is but a reflection of a crisis in, or a division, I should say, between those who want to pressure Putin, perhaps out of office, bringing about what we could call a color revolution in Russia, by putting nuclear and conventional military forces near to Russia's borders, Western borders. But this is but a manifestation of a larger malaise in the foreign policy of the United States. Now, let us not forget, the U.S. military has operated for some time off of this doctrine of full-spectrum dominance. In other words, two major wars and a secondary war, two and a half wars at the same time. now, the question is the United States military and the ruling elites prepared to go to war with Russia and China and Iran at the same time? Or does Trump's gestures towards Russia indicate a pullback from empire itself? Now, on balance, if you take Tillerson and Trump's statements about North Korea, which, in my opinion, are dangerous. They're dangerous statements. But then, on the other side, you take their stance, or at least Trump's stance, on Russia. Well, you can't have them both at the same time, it seems to me. They are logically going in opposite and contradictory directions. You can't have war on the Korean Peninsula and peace with Russia, because, as you know, North Korea borders not only China, but Russia as well. But the other thing is that China and Russia are strategically aligned. I would say that objectively, what we are looking at is an imperial pullback, and it is not a neat affair. It's a very messy affair. the pullback from empire. It is unaffordable. It is facing too many complications and obstacles on a world scale. For example, you know, Angela Merkel's government had been kind of a American surrogate in ratcheting up tensions in Central Europe with Russia.
Right.
Well, as we saw with Trump and Merkel, and you compare that with the meeting between Trump and May, that it would seem that the Trump administration is favoring a U.S.-British alliance over a U.S.-German alliance. And perhaps, depending on what happens in the French elections coming up, that perhaps we'll have a U.S.-British-French alliance, which isolates Germany, which then forces the hand of the German elite to, it seems to me, move away from their belligerent attitude towards Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you put all this together, it's a messy situation, but I think what we're looking at is a retreat from at least the most warlike positions held by the American elites over the last 20, 25 years.
You know, and we've been talking for months, really, about the possibility. I mean, this is, you know, only our speculation piled on top of the statements that have come out of the Trump campaign and the Trump transition team and the Trump White House on various occasions, and only some of those, since there are so many contradictory statements coming out now, like Nikki Haley and some others. But we've been looking at those statements against events on the ground and wondering if, in fact, that the role that the Trump administration hopes to play is to back away from hegemony as our foreign policy, or as U.S. foreign policy, and move towards something more collegial or collaborative, where there's an acknowledgement that there are other centers of power, and engaging from a position of relative strength as the largest or second largest economy, the largest military, one of the wealthiest economies, and yada, yada, yada. And engaging, you know, at the conference table with everyone, saying, let's cut new deals and make some money together.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an irony to the whole thing. You know, Trump is talking about a world of nation states, where the nation state, rather than the European Union or the economic and financial alliances based, let us say, upon the Trans-Pacific Partnership or other types of agreements that are then said to have the force of law, and thus the world order is governed by a legal superstructure. But and so Trump is talking about bilateralism in the relationships between nations, and the restoring of the place of the nation state in international relationships, rather than the diminishing of the nation state. The European Union, perhaps, is the greatest example of that.
And, you know, there's an element to that also. I mean, the essence of that, really, is the issue of national sovereignty as opposed to unbridled transnational corporate control, which is what those other institutions
represent.
That's
the point. And the question of citizenship. What are the rights of a citizen, and what rights of citizens of nations are protected? I mean, there are a lot of implications to which way you go on these issues. But the problem that I was trying to address with the Trump, at least the narrative of economic nationalism, as opposed to multilateralism, is the fact that the United States is confronted with a world where other nations and groups of nations are forming alliances of their own. For example, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for one, which is anchored in the relationship between China and Russia, or the new strategic alliance between China and Russia, or Mercosul, or ALBA in South America, or the BRIC nations. You know, all of these new alliances which move in the direction of a, I wouldn't even call it a multipolar world, I think we can call it that, but a world of new alliances of nations. So it is not just China that concerns American elites, or should concern American elites. It is all of the alliances and relationships between China and, for instance, let us say, all of those nations that have bought in to the Asian Infrastructure Bank. And they not only include Asian nations, but also include European nations, many allies of the United States. And this is seen as a competitor with the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Or you take the BRIC Bank, which is also seen as a competitor with the World Bank and the IMF. But all of this represents a world of new alliances where indeed the nation state is augmented and strengthened by its relationships with other nations. But to do all of this, the idea of a single hegemon can no longer have a lot of strength in this kind of new world. And we see it developing around what China is doing. I think China is the major player. And again, you know, when Trump talks about what he wants to do or what he will do in North Korea, he can do nothing in North Korea that does not take into account China, South Korea, Japan, and the whole East Asian sphere. So I think we're in a new world, in the sense of not only is it not a unipolar world with a single hegemon, but it's a world where nations are seeking ways to develop their relationships built upon non-hegemonic, non-interventionist, empire-building logics. And I think this is good. I think this has thrown the American ruling elite, irrespective of political party or worldview, into a deep crisis. And if I might just say, I think what is happening in terms of the world kind of explains the cheap politics of the Trump administration, for example, with Jeff Sessions, the head of the Justice Department, coming out today talking about they are going to look at overturning all of the former Justice Department's consent decrees with various police forces, like in Ferguson, like in Baltimore, and trying to get some control over rogue and killer cops and institutionalize brutality and murder against people of color. That is very cheap, but it's a way to get some cheap political point and bolster up what you consider to be your base. I think the attempt to replace and repeal Obamacare became a debacle because within the Republican Party, there are two sides of this whole question of fiscal and budgetary matters, which the, you know, the healthcare thing ultimately comes down to. And I guess, you know, finally, you know, they're up against a constituency, a Trump constituency, which is not going to wait much longer. They want health care. Basically, they want universal health care. They want jobs. And he promises $1 trillion in infrastructure development. And how he gets that through a Republican House when he could not get the repeal and replace of Obamacare through, I don't know. So I just say all of this to say that like one political German political economist has suggested, whose name escapes me right now, for capitalism, we're entering a long period of something like a dark ages. And like Gramsci said, the old is dying, but the new is not yet ready to be born.
Yeah, and the moment is extremely pregnant, maybe 10 months pregnant, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Or more, with triplets.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess, you know, I guess what we have to conclude ultimately is that Trump is a part of the crisis. He does not have a way to resolve the crisis. Hillary, had she won, would have had the people who could attempt to manage all of this without resolving it. But Trump does not even have the people, the technical people who could manage this type of crisis. To his credit, he, in spite of some statements that I think were and are ill-advised and stupid, I still think he represented to millions of voters a detente, a moving away from wars of intervention. Certainly, his statements recently that he reversed the policy of the Obama administration, which was predicated upon getting rid of Assad in Syria. He's not for that.
Right.
And he's in an objective alliance with the anti-ISIL forces that include Hezbollah and Iran and Russia and the Syrian Arab Army.
Right.
So that is to his credit. He is not as incompetent as people like to make him out to be. He recognizes something. He's very truthful and honest about it, that America and American imperialism cannot afford to manage the world as an empire and must retreat from that.
Just on the point of Susan Rice, you know, what it appears she was doing from the reports today, and I have to remind people, she first came into politics at the beginning of the first Clinton administration as an appointee there on the at the National Security Council, and came back during the administration of Obama to where she ended up being the director, that the spying on the Trump transition team and its foreign contacts, of course, would be certainly to find out what they intended to do in terms of changes in foreign policy based on the campaign rhetoric and would bear on these points.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. You know, and of course, Trump has inherited. He is the president of an empire, of a bureaucracy and a political establishment committed pretty much to hegemony, world hegemony and empire.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.